Hi, this is Paul. As those of you who are on Twitter know, there's a little clip from a TEDx talk given by Yuval Harari that's been making the rounds, where he talks about kidneys and mountains are real, human rights are not. I'll put a link below. Glenn Scrivener sort of took the whole thing and sort of packaged it up into one nice tweet thread, because Glenn, of course, has been working with this theme, a la Tom Holland, for quite a while. And what caught my attention with this is that it was one of the first time, or one of the few times, it's the only time that I had seen Jordan Peterson and Tom Holland respond to the same thing on Twitter. And in fact, Jordan Peterson responded to Tom Holland's tweet. Well, maybe not enough context. Here's the context.
Many, maybe most legal systems are based on this idea, this belief in human rights. But human rights are just like heaven and like God. It's just a fictional story that we've invented and spread around. It may be a very nice story. It may be a very attractive story. We want to believe it. But it's just a story. It's not a reality. It is not a biological reality. Just as jellyfish and woodpeckers and ostriches have no rights, Homo sapiens have no rights also. Take a human, cut him open, look inside, you find their blood, and you find the heart and lungs and kidneys, but you don't find there any rights. The only place you find rights is in the fictional stories that humans have invented and spread around. And the same thing is also true in the political field. States and nations are also, like human rights, and like God, and like heaven, they too are just stories. A mountain is a reality. You can see it, you can touch it, you can even smell it. But Israel or the United States, they are just stories, very powerful stories, stories we might want to believe very much, but still they are just stories.
Now, he made this point in his book, Sapiens. I'd read his book, Sapiens, a number of years ago, and I read Homo Deus a number of years ago. I just saw that Cale Zeldin had posted a clip that someone had posted about him talking about how AI and robotics are going to make humans, we're going to have way too many surplus, useless humans on the planet. That he had made a statement. This was years ago. He's been making these statements for years. What's interesting, and what struck me as interesting about this, was that Tom Holland had basically made almost the exact same point, and has been making almost the exact same point, sort of in the opposite direction.
We'll start with Gavin at the front here. Questions?
That's Gavin Ashenden, who asked the question.
Not statements, we haven't got much time. Thank you.
I want to throw back to Tom a question.
One of the things that I've been really learning is how small a country the UK is and England is, and how much everybody sort of knows each other there. It's really quite remarkable. It's in some ways one city with it kind of works that way, especially because how many people went through Oxford.
He wants to ask me, but I'd like him to answer it. Tom, once we had a small discussion, and you said the very distinctive thing about the church was that, as you quite just said, it really does believe in good and evil. It's nothing if it doesn't have a metaphysical vision. Most of the people here, I think, would sign up to that metaphysics. One difficulty we have is persuading a highly secularized society that our metaphysical vision isn't something at the level of Victorian fairy tales. As someone who straddles both worlds, do you have any advice for us in the way in which we can reacquaint our society with the seriousness of what is almost a dualistic metaphysical narrative in order to catch their imagination sufficiently for us to be able to tell the Christian story with effect?
Well, I think the key is for people in the West to be culturally humble and to recognize that their values are not universal, as I said. So another one would obviously be human rights. Because the West has been so hegemonic for so long, it's been in a position to assume that its concept of human rights is somehow universal. They don't need to think about it. course human rights exist. But what the rise of China and of other civilizational powers is doing is to remind us that the concept of human rights is one that has emerged in a very specific cultural matrix, which is a Christian one. And that therefore, if you want to believe in human rights, you have to believe. It takes a leap of faith to believe that there are things called human rights, just as much as it takes a leap of faith to believe that the Lord Jesus Christ raised from the dead. They're both beliefs. And the fact that you know, most people in the West sign up to the fact that human rights exist and that they're important and that they should determine, say, you know, national policy, public policy, actually, it's as rooted in theology and myth and metaphysics as all the teachings of Christianity. And I think that once people are reminded of that, I think it becomes impossible not to feel a kind of greater sense of where, you know, what Christianity is about. Because, you know, if you believe in human rights, why not believe that Jesus rose from the dead? You might as well hang for a sheep as a lamb. I think that it reminding people that the core beliefs that are fundamental to how people morally define themselves is rooted in faith reopens the possibility for secularists to recognize that they are not somehow, they have not kind of emancipated themselves from the need for faith. They continue to illustrate it. And I think that kind of contemplating that then reopens the possibility to think, well, where might this practice of believing in fantastical things lead? But I think one of the things that the churches need to do is to kind of absolutely embrace this, rather than being slightly embarrassed about it and only talking about the kind of things that you'd hear on a Liberal Democrat Party political broadcast, which is a kind of, you know, thought for the day thing. I mean, I think that thought for the day and, you know, the kind of religious studies GCSE where you compare what Buddhists and Muslims think about smoking, that kind of stuff, I think it's absolutely destructive because it just kind of makes everything a mush. I think that the churches have to lay claim to everything that is kind of most, that is weirdest, most countercultural, most peculiar. You know, don't kind of duck all the stuff about angels and things. I mean, major on that, because...
So that very much brought in, you know, my comments about steep slope Christianity. And what was interesting to me is that Harari and Tom Holland are making the same point to very different ends. Now, Harari, in his books, we'll talk about that, the fact that the dollar is a fiction and all of these other things are a fiction. So it isn't. What struck me as interesting, however, was how often I'd hear celebrity atheists sort of knock Jordan Peterson on this point. Rationality Rules did it. This emerged when Jordan Peterson had his conversation with Jonathan Peugeot and Douglas Murray, where they're talking about it as a fiction. And Jordan Peterson used that word, a fiction, and Jonathan Peugeot sort of winces.
Yeah, well, the question then becomes, what is that leap? So let me offer you a proposition here, and you tell me what you think about this, and then maybe Jonathan can chime in. So, you know, the battle between the atheist, rationalist, materialists, let's say, and the religious types, if it's played out on the battleground set by the atheist materialists, is a battle between the claims that the scientific mode of explanation and the religious mode of explanation are alike in kind but different in conclusion, and so that you have a description of the world where God's a causal agent and you have a description of the world where natural processes are causal agents, and the scientists tend to win that battle. But then I think, well, there's a problem with that, because it isn't obvious to me at all that the way that God is conceptualized in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and maybe more universally, is as an analog of a material cause. If I look through the biblical canon and the way that God is characterized as a character, let's say, in some sense as a fictional character, and I'll return to that idea, his essence is something more like role model and spirit to emulate. It's something like a mode of being. It's an enacted mode of being in the world rather than a pure causal agent. And the problem with the scientific endeavor is that, as Hume so famously pointed out, there's a huge gap between is and ought. And what I see offered on the religious front is an answer to the question of ought. And then I'll add one more thing to that. So this is how you ought to behave. But not only to behave, but how you ought to perceive, how you ought to make a hierarchy of your attentional resources so that you're looking at the right thing and acting in the right way toward the proper goals all the time. How do you orient yourself to do that? And so that, and I don't think that the atheist types can't respond to that, because there's no way that they can produce an ethic on the fly in some sense. And that was Hume's objection. And it also, thinking about the problem this way, see, it also opens the door to a deeper understanding of the role that fiction and mythology play, because you can think of fiction, including mythology, as a form of abstraction that characterizes patterns of behavior and action, rather than a form of abstraction that describes the world the way science does. And that way, fiction becomes a different kind of truth, which is a pragmatic truth rather than a descriptive or propositional truth. And it's oriented towards ethics and the direction of attention. And so
Now, I made those videos about the conversation between Alex O'Connor and Richard Dawkins. And again, I don't have a lot of time right now to sort of put the things back and forth. But if you watch that video and you listen to what Jordan says here, I believe after this video, Alex kind of mocks and plays with this fictional thing, and I think rationality rules too. I think they both did videos on this because they saw this and they sort of pounced. But what was interesting is that now, how many months later, the ideas sort of seep in, like water recharging an underground water table. I see this all the time with people. This is the benefit of being a little bit older. In that, I made this comment recently about, you know, certain regular watchers of the channel, they might be hate watching, they might be doing all these things, they're leaving snarky comments, but I watch those comments over time, and what happens, sort of like Alex O'Connor, is that gravity has its effect, and if it's a good argument, it begins to sink in, and it begins to take root, and that water begins to accumulate.
Increasingly thinking about the heavenly hierarchy as a internal, in some sense, psychological structure through which we see the world. And I'll add one more thing to that and turn it over to Jonathan. The other thing that strikes me as psychologically unassailable is the fact that you need a uniting principle to orient your perceptions and actions toward for three fundamental reasons. One is, if you're aiming towards something valuable, that gives you positive emotion and hope. And so all the motivation that goes along with that fills you with enthusiasm. Second, if you don't have a uniting ethic that governs your own perceptions and actions, then you're confused and in disarray. And the cost of that is anxiety and hopelessness and pain and frustration and disappointment and grief. All of the negative emotions. And then third, if you don't have a uniting ethic, and so that has to be united under something like a monotheistic superordinate entity, if you don't have that, then you have social disarray, because there's nothing that unites people in their common ethical pursuit, and that's their behavior and their perceptions. And so I'll let Jonathan comment on that a bit.
I think what you're saying is right on track. That is, one of the problems that happened in the story of Christianity is something like the Enlightenment and modernism, which is that as the world was moving towards this notion of mechanical causation and the interest in mechanical causation, came to be a misunderstanding of the way that traditional Christians believed the world actually existed. And so there's a difference between the material causes and something like the vertical cause of something. And the vertical cause of something is exactly this hierarchy that Jordan is talking about. And I would push what Jordan is saying even further. That is, it does actually affect, to a certain extent, even the is, because we can't perceive an is without a hierarchy of attention and without a hierarchy of perception, because the world is indefinite in detail and in quantity. And so for even to be able to say this, to point to something, to say that.
Right there is the combinatory explosive idea that is in many ways just under this whole thing. That is the idea that has been destroying modernity and destroying this particular epistemology, because humans can't wield an epistemology that takes in everything. Humans have to limit and focus, and it's the hierarchies that force the focusing, and Jordan basically just laid out, well, when it comes to a culture, you have to have something like that that helps everybody see the same thing. Going back to Damian Walter's video with Ian McGilchrist, Ian really nicely right here notice it talks about the fact that, well, by the, part of the reason we have the bicameral mind is attention. And attention determines what we see. And the more we begin to realize this, you talk about low-status men and low-status women being unseen. You look at the gorilla in the middle of the psychological experiment of moving the basketball around. The gorilla isn't even seen. Now, we all know that the gorilla was there, but it's not seen. You talk about the god on the other shore not being seen.
Please do.
Yeah.
Please do. Yeah.
First of all, it's a very evolutionarily verifiable hypothesis, if you like. The idea is that the two hemispheres of the brain evolved differently, not just in human beings, but in pretty much all creatures we've looked at, to solve a particular problem, which is how to pay two kinds of attention to the world at the same time. One kind of attention is required for survival in the simplest sense, that we need to get stuff. We need to grab food, we need to catch a rabbit, we need to pick up a seed, whatever it is. And we need also to be able to manipulate our environment, to pick things up and build things and use tools and so on, in the case of human beings. So, in fact, as far back as we can go in history, 700 million years, we know that the neural networks that form the ancestors of the human brain were asymmetrical, which is interesting in itself. Why were they asymmetrical? And I think the reason for this was that, as I say, two kinds of attention need to be paid. One is the one with which we grab things, and this is the one subtended by us, in us, by the left hemisphere. And it therefore pays attention to something that we already know what it is, we know we want it, and we need to get it. And so it focuses in a targeted way, a very narrow beam of attention that brings clarity. But the difficulty with this is that it is not seeing everything else that's going on at the same time. And so in order to survive, you also need to be looking out for predators, not just predators, but also for your kin, for your offspring, for your mate, for your kind. And to do this, you need precisely the opposite kind of attention, maximally open, undedicated yet as to what it may find, and broad, sustained, and on the lookout, vigilant. So very different from this attention. I know what it is, I want to get it, it's a detail. The right hemisphere is looking out for the whole of the rest of it. So
that whole of the rest of it is going to not just include the physical things around there, but it's fundamentally relational. If you're in a city and you notice that you have to walk through a dark alley, well, who's afraid of the darkness? Or if you're walking through a graveyard, why are you getting nervous? I mean, it in fact is sort of a mapping of a worldview, because all of those things have to do with threat. So on one hand, the emissary brain is focusing on the little thing that they're looking for, and the master brain is taking a look at the big picture. And this is part of the reason why you can have someone who is physically healthy, they've got nothing wrong with their body, but they are depressed because of nihilism, they're depressed because of someone died in their family. They're depressed because their girlfriend broke up with them. They're depressed because they look around the country and they don't think they have a future. It's all that other brain. And it's relational. It's often non-physical because you're worried about threats that are not physical. When somebody dies and you're depressed, that's not a physical threat, but it impacts you physiologically because it impacts that sense of awareness and the attention that you are paying for that. Now, Justin Brierley in this week's The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God talks about the Harari thing and goes with Glenn Scrivener and goes with Tom Holland. Now, what's interesting is that you keep getting to this word grounded. And for a very long time, I've been rather annoyed by this word grounded. Now, it is a metaphor, and it's a metaphor for something that's very, it's not a bad word. There's nothing wrong with the word, but I think there are better words and better metaphors for actually understanding how these ideas, these stories, like human rights, become compelling for us.
Sexual abuse, and for marriage to only be entered into by consenting adults. But where had this remarkable set of rights actually come from? When I sat down for a big conversation from Premier Unbelievable with Harvard academic and atheist Steven Pinker, in conversation with Christian thinker Nick Spencer, Pinker was adamant that a commitment to humanism is all that's needed to guarantee human rights.
Well, I think they're stable enough to result, for example, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which has not a shred of Christianity in it.
Let me push back on that. The Universal Declaration was drafted by Charles Malik, who was a Lebanese Christian, and it's very telling that the word person appears in the UN Declaration six times. That person is rooted in the personalism which was mainstreamed by Catholic social teaching in the 30s and 40s. So the UNHDR are absolutely right, as Maritain said, and as you rightly quote, it deliberately doesn't draw on any metaphysical foundations because we want people to agree. But you can see the fingerprints of personalism in the drafting.
Again, you know, historically you can see fingerprints of many things, and Maritain convened a council of multi-confessional intellectuals and moralists, Hindus and Confucians and Muslims.
See, I would make the argument, as I've made in some previous videos, that in fact Christianity, secularity has been smuggling Jesus into these other religious groups in terms of their practice for a very long time. And so the fact that when they would all get together to do something like work for the United Nations, that they would all sound in some ways downstream from mainline American Christianity doesn't surprise me a bit.
And indeed was pleasantly surprised that there was so much agreement. I think there's a perfectly robust justification for humanism. Atheism is not itself a belief system. It's the absence of one particular belief, namely in supernatural entities.
And that's that classic Mott and Bailey approach with atheism. I mean, some people, you have to get rid of religion and adopt atheism. Or just get rid of religion, and it's like, well, what's in its place? Well, atheism. Well, if the religion is massive, then atheism must be massive. Oh, no, atheism is just the denial that there's a God. Okay, but what about all that other functionality that religion has been doing for you? I've talked about common religion and civilizational religion. What's operating there? And you can look at a guy like Clay Routledge and now Peter Boghossian and many others who have basically been aware of that. Okay, if you're gonna say atheism is just a tiny little thing, something else is filling everything. It might be wokeism. It might be a different religion. It might be superstitions of various kinds, and generally speaking, just the personal codes and morality that haven't necessarily been tagged to a religious thing. Go back to Christian Smith's work, Soul Searching, and most of the young people in the 90s that he interviewed just said, well, all of these ethics are just self-evident. Oh, so basically, that's a way of saying that's part of the first draft of the map you inherited from your parents. And in fact, many of the people, if you read Soul Searching, many of the people will just say, I learned my ethics and morality from my parents. Well, I wonder where they got it from. They got it from their parents, and on and on and on and on. So you know, Pinker's not doing real well here.
Aside from that, there isn't any such belief as atheism. But humanism is grounded in our universal humanity, the fact we're made of the same...
Okay, grounded in our universal humanity. But then you have Yuval Harari and Tom Holland, who are both saying, when you say grounded in our universal humanity, just like Yuval Harari says, well, if you dissect a person and you find kidneys and intestines and all of these, you won't find a universal humanity in there, just like you won't find a religion, just like you won't find a soul, just like you won't find mother's love, just like you won't find love for your nation, just like, and none of those things you will find in an autopsy. You won't even find whether the person was a moral person or a jerk, unless there's some, let's say, disease or some physical manifestation that you can somehow tie or want to tie to some moral aspect. You're just not going to find any of that in there. So, you know, then to have Pinker say, our common humanity. Okay, where are you going to find that? Did we find that somewhere in the Arizona desert and dig it up and pass it around and salt our food with it? Is that how we get this universal humanity? Show it to me. Well, no, you can't show it anywhere. But notice, again, keep paying attention to this word ground.
Tough. We're the same species. We all are sentient. We all have the capacity to experience pleasure and pain. We all have the capacity to reason. And that is a pretty rock-solid foundation for universal human rights and universal human dignity.
I think it's just the worst argument in the world. Because people have had all of those things, and people have been absolute monsters to each other for, you know, pretty much all of human history. So, grounding? What do you mean grounding? What kind of metaphor is this?
Nick Spencer is the author of books including The Evolution of the West, How Christianity Has Shaped Our Values, and in contrast to Pinker, believes that the West's commitment to human rights, and indeed humanism, has deeply Christian roots. Only moments earlier, he had argued why.
I would argue, and I know this is obviously where Stephen and I would part company, that there is a secure basis for humanism within Christian thought.
Again. Basis. Look at the structure of this, of all of these metaphors. And again, it makes sense. I mean, Jesus uses it with build your house on the sand, build your house on the rock.
Then there is within atheist thought. So, for example, I would say that a commitment of humanism is ineradicable human dignity and fundamental human equality. Now, you can understand that, and you can trace, you can historically trace that through European thought, certainly, and you can, as it were, justify it on theological grounds if you do that kind of thing. I don't doubt that many of my atheist friends are committed to human dignity or human equality. I can't see, as it were, where the deep foundations for that are. I don't think reason in and of itself, let alone science.
Again, there's that metaphor, deep foundations. Now, reason isn't quite... You know, first principles, I mean, all of these sort of structural arguments about trying to make something secure and permanent. And again, maybe this goes all the way back to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, where build your house on the rock or build your house on the sand. It's the same metaphor. And again, it's not a bad metaphor, but we'll get there.
Science acts as a sufficiently robust foundation for that commitment. So it's not that I want to say that atheist humanists are not committed to human dignity and equality at all. It's just that I don't think their foundations are quite stable.
There's the word again.
Enough.
Like Spencer, I find it hard to justify the idea that such lofty concepts as the inherent freedom, equality, and dignity of all humans can be grounded in abstract scientific fact.
Grounded.
Or our capacity for reason. What exactly is it about being born with the genetic identity of Homo sapiens that suddenly confers the United Declaration of Human Rights' long list of inalienable rights and freedoms upon an individual? Science itself has nothing to say on the matter. And when it comes to atrocities such as the Nazis' eugenics programs, science has frequently been employed to the detriment of these rights. An even older and more famous document, the United States Declaration of Independence, drafted in 1776, was a precursor to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men...
hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created essentially same.
Mention of Christian here in a widely viewed TED Talk.
Most legal systems today in the world are based on...
So there's the Yuval Harari thing.
...on a belief in...
fiction and may one day cease to exist. In his follow-up book, Homo Deus, he explores a dystopian prediction of a transhumanist future in which outdated thinking about human rights will inevitably be replaced by a new social and moral...
So here's our anxiety.
...moral order as science, technology, and AI allows humans to escape their physical, mortal, and maybe even moral limitations. This is Glenn Scrivener, author of The Air We Breathe, reflecting on Harari's approach.
This TED Talk, he says, human rights are not found as a biological reality. They are just found in the stories that we have told. Those stories might be great stories, but they are just stories that involve the gods. And he's very clear, certainly in Sapiens, that it's... from the Christian, from the Bible, that we get this sense of humanity made in God's image, and that's where we got the idea of human rights.
Okay, now I want to argue that it's this story thing is actually more important, and it's much more the air we breathe, which is again another one of Glenn's ideas. In fact, that is the title of Glenn's book, The Air We Breathe. and I think that's actually better than the foundational metaphors. And this actually goes right to the point, but to the interaction between Jordan and Tom on Twitter. So Tom Holland is responding to Anthony Cox, who is quoting Tom Holland's Dominion. The West, over the duration of its global hegemony, had become skilled in the art of repackaging Christian concepts for non-Christian audiences. A doctrine such as that of human rights was far likelier to be signed up for if its origin among the canon lawyers of medieval Europe could be kept concealed. The incidence of United Nations agency on the antiquity and broad acceptance of the conception of human rights was a necessary precondition for their claim to a global rather than merely Western jurisdiction, secularism, and identical manner, dependent on the care with which it covered its tracks. So again, Christians have learned to smuggle. They've learned to smuggle well, and others have picked this up. You go to a yoga studio, say, no, this isn't a religion. This is exercise. Oh, okay. There's no religion behind any of this? How about some of these Buddhist ideas? No. Buddhism isn't a religion. And of course, I've mentioned many times in the 1970s, people would say, Christianity isn't a religion, it's a relationship. And all of these things are banking on sort of a reaction to religion. And so we're not going to come up front with our religion. We're just going to hide it. But we're going to, human rights, and we're going to sneak that in. Well, obviously, there are certain incentives for human rights that we all like to appeal to our rights when we feel that we're endangered or we think that it would get us ahead or something like that. So actually, this idea of human rights has been very popular because people have pretty quickly realized that, well, this can actually be useful if we have some of this, rather than just saying, I have all the power, so tough luck for you, and off you go. Tom Holland says yes, to his own quote. Human rights have no more objective reality than, let's say, the Trinity. Both derive from the workings of Christian theology, and both, if they are to be believed, require people to make a leap of faith. I think Glenn's The Air We Breathe, and that was made, Glenn used Australia in a previous episode of The Surprising Rebirth of Christianity when he talked about, so Glenn is actually Australian, he lives in the UK, and whenever he flies back to Australia, when the plane lands in Sydney and the doors open, suddenly he can just smell the sweet, whatever it is, the pollen or whatever that eucalyptus is putting in the air. There it is, and he knows he's in Australia. Now, after he's in the country for 5 minutes, he won't even notice it. But it's just seeping in under the radar, and this is exactly what's been doing. And I mentioned already Soul Searching, Christian Smith's book, where he's interviewing teenagers, and they just say, oh, it's just self-evident. And then you push a little further. I got it from my parents. Oh, okay. So So there's actually, I think we could use another one. We could use sort of like a herd immunity metaphor. That in fact, if enough people around you believe this, you will believe this. This is, again, one of my arguments for, actually, Elizabeth Oldfield in a question and answer recently made this point too, and I've made it a number of times before, that if you wish to aspire to believe in something, spend time with people who believe it already, and you will catch the belief. Because we believe in groups, and that is true of this. Now, Jordan weighs in, and Jordan says, not exactly, Tom Holland. The doctrine of rights will soon be shown to be an inexorable consequence of the semantic network of meaning. Now, Jordan's not always easy to understand, which is why people listen to my videos, because I'm a Jordan Peterson interpreter at times. That it's encoded implicitly in the relationship not only between words and verbal concepts, but stories and patterns of behavior. Built into the structure of human beings and perhaps in being, capital B, itself. In other words, rights are the semantic representation of the archetypal reality that characterizes sustainable, upwards-oriented, reciprocally altruistic human interactions. I really hope the book that he's writing isn't filled with sentences like this. That was maps of meaning. And 12 Rules for Life sold significantly better because he pitched it to a different audience. He says he's writing two books. Maybe one is more of a technical book and the other is more of a popular book. Basically, that's a fancy way of saying what he's been saying pretty much all along. He was making... What's remarkable about a number of these people, Tom Holland's been making this speech for a long time. And you can go back a number of years and find videos of him making it. Jordan Peterson's been making this point for a long time. Jordan Peterson finds it much more in sort of the structure of the world. In other words, and again, Christians who believe that they are increasingly in alignment with the Creator God aren't going to challenge him on this at all. But that this is the structure, this is part of the structure of language, structure of relationships, structure, as he says, of even being itself. It's in our biology, it's all the way down here, and basically all of these other ways, both sort of the herd immunity way, the impulse by Christianity way, what Jesus had done is sort of open our eyes to this reality. Now, again, Christianity asserts that Jesus is both the saving God and the creating God. That's very early in a number of the New Testament books. What's interesting is sort of Jordan gets at this through the story verse. Now, the rest of history just had a really fun and fascinating episode on Romans in space, Star Wars, Dune, Star Trek. And in some ways, you hear sort of echoes of Jordan Peterson's archetypal stuff. Of course, Star Wars has Joseph Campbell behind it. A lot of people would argue that, well, you basically get the sense that the point that I made a couple videos ago, that there structurally, there are just a certain limited number of responses on the menu that come up again and again and again. And so certain archetypes start coming through civilizationally again and again and again and again.
Predictions for the future did you offer?
I did something on Undead Rome. I did it on looking at how ideas of Rome motivated Vladimir Putin.
Crikey.
We ended up talking about it in one of the episodes. You know, never let anything go to waste. Anyway, this is still quite a current idea.
Yeah.
But in the context of this idea that Gibbon articulates, that the fall of the Roman Empire is the greatest, perhaps, and most awful scene in the history of mankind, he famously says, There is a great twist in the second novel, which is that Harry Seldon's reading of history turns out to go wrong. An event happens that he couldn't have foreseen.
Now, they're talking about Isaac Asimov's series Foundations. And so, again, sort of a nice key back into science fiction here.
And this is the emergence of a character called the Mule, who is a mutant telepath.
Yeah.
So he can read and manipulate the emotions of other people. And he ends up conquering the galaxy and conquering the Foundation. He has not been predicted. And I think that this is pretty clearly an echo of Muhammad. It's a fairly hostile portrayal of Muhammad. The Mule is a kind of, he's an arrogant conqueror.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is an interesting twist, because essentially what Asimov is saying there is that the emergence of Islam is a kind of, you know, a lightning bolt from the blue. It couldn't have been anticipated or foreseen. It's something so startling and unexpected that even the most highly advanced psycho-historians could not have anticipated it. And that, of course, is buying into the traditional Islamic narrative.
I was about to say
that
yeah.
Islam emerges because it is a revelation of God rather than emerging, as I think it probably did, in quite a predictable way from the kind of the melange of opinions and religious beliefs.
So if Harry Seldon is a psycho, what is he, a psycho historian?
Yeah.
If he'd been trained in the sort of 1970s and 1980s by sort of a Patricia Kroner figure, Tom.
Yeah, he might have seen it.
He would have seen it coming, because he would have said Islam emerged out of the superpower conflicts in Arabia between the Romans and the Persians and stuff. But I guess what Asimov is reflecting is the orthodox historiography about the rise of Islam and the sort of 7th century at the time he was writing in the 1950s, right?
As is another equally celebrated work of science fiction, a series of novels like Foundation that, again, have inspired not TV in this case, but a couple of films so far that are out on release. And that's...
So again, these same things keep coming up again and again and again. And it isn't necessarily that the authors are copying. It's there's sort of a gully in the structure of reality that makes all of the rain run through the channel in that way.
And that's Dune.
Right.
And Dune was written in the 60s by a guy called Frank Herbert. And it's set on an inhospitable desert, a bit like, Tatooine, is it?
Tatooine.
In Star Wars?
Or Jakku.
So this is Arrakis.
Yeah.
It's full of giant kind of sandworms and things. But what Arrakis produces is a kind of weird thing called spice.
Yes.
That effectively powers space travel.
Which is also called mélange. Rather oddly.
Or mélange, yes. So it's, I mean, this is just before OPEC, so it's pretty clear that this is
oil. You
know, spice in a way is oil.
Yeah.
But I think it is clearly also an echo of the idea that was very, very current when Herbert was writing this, and which Patricia Kroner delivered a kind of devastating rebuttal to. The idea that Mecca had been a great center of the spice trade, and that this is the context from which Muhammad emerges, that Mecca was this hugely significant center. I think it's absolutely clear that it wasn't at all.
Okay.
And that this sense of Mecca as a center of spice trade is a kind of orientalist fantasy that's projected onto the understanding of Islam by Western scholars who have this idea that anything oriental must have to do with spice. And then it's turbocharged by the oil crisis.
Why does it matter in the history of Islam and the sort of collapse of the Roman authority in the Eastern Mediterranean? Why does it matter whether Mecca had spices or not?
I don't think it does particularly matter. I mean, it matters very much to explaining the traditional accounts of Islam as history, because in the traditional accounts, Mecca is clearly a very significant settlement with all kinds of competing aristocracies. And historically, that doesn't seem to have been the case. There is no record of a Mecca that would correspond to a center that rich and that significant in any of the contemporary sources.
But that idea of competing clans and aristocracies fighting for control of the spice trade, let's say, I mean, that is the plot of Dune, isn't it?
Yes.
The Harkonnens and the House Atreus, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Greek name.
Yeah, it is. So the House of Atreus, that's the family of Agamemnon.
Yeah.
And Paul Atreides, so Paul, the son of Atreus, actually, the parallels are not really with Greek myth. It's with Islamic history, I think, because Paul goes on to become Mu'addib, which in Arabic means teacher, although in Dune it actually means kangaroo mouse.
Right.
So it's one of the animals of the of the desert. And he goes on to kind of become a prophetic figure, a great religious leader. He launches this jihad, which ends up consuming the entire galactic empire. Quite Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that this is consciously inspired by the way that Islam is a terminal event in the long run for the Roman Empire, and suggests that you know, for these deeply totemic science fiction stories, it's the fall of the Roman Empire rather than the fall of the Roman Republic that is the kind of the great inspiration.
Just one thing on Paul. Paul is also, so we talked about Luke Skywalker is King Arthur. Paul is also King Arthur as well, isn't he?
He is.
Sort of,
yeah.
he has this sort of providential destiny that he is sort of fated. You know, people talk about him in hushed tones. Is he going to be the person who fulfills the prophecy and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, and I think that that's so interesting. I mean, you're absolutely right. There are echoes of Arthur as well as of Muhammad. And both of them, so the stories of Arthur are starting to emerge and be written down at around the same time as the biographies of Muhammad. The first biographies of Muhammad are starting to be written kind of around 800 AD. And both of them are kind of responses to the collapse of the Roman Empire. They're both about the emergence of charismatic figures on the margins of the empire who take control of abandoned imperial territory. Mm. And so that's why I think it's possible to see, say, in Dune, echoes both of Arthur and of Muhammad in this story,
yeah.
Because the original stories are both generated by this kind of catastrophic event, if you're Roman. And I think it's clear why science fiction offers scope for people who want to explore the kind of the great dramas of ancient history, but don't want to write historical fiction. Because if you have an enormous galactic empire, you know, you can make play with that,
yeah,
in a way that you can't just, you know, down on Earth.
Yes.
So like Battlestar Galactica would be another example of that, I guess.
Oh, yeah, of course, Battlestar Galactica, which is kind of Mormonism.
I can't, yeah.
There is this idea that it's inspired by the idea of the Mormons. Anyway, so Tom, do you have anything else up your...
So, you know, you just see these patterns. And again, you with these patterns, as with a lot of symbolism, there's always a, well, how do we know it's this and not that? Well, again, it's the mastermind looking for patterns, the master brain looking for patterns, watching this, looking for all of these things, and then just sort of noticing the patterns and gullies in being, let's say. And I think when you have an accumulation of all of these things in a culture, you have the stories, you have the herd immunity, you have the you have people of high status embracing it. I mean, this is, I think, part of where Aaron Wren is important, because in terms of the evangelicals have been consistently populist, but Aaron Wren has been the one exception who has said, now pay attention, because the status things are actually pretty important in this. And a lot of that tension, I think, goes right back to the tensions that are around Jesus Christ. He's the Son of God, he's the Son of Man, he's the King of Kings, he's all of these, and he's also the servant of all, and he dies on a cross. And all of those tensions just back and forth. And that's why, you know, in my conversation with Jonathan Peugeot, it's just the most incredible story you could imagine. So I wanted to pull all of these things together, and I hope that Harari TED thing doesn't cause me problems. I'll maybe have to make two versions of this, one with it, one without, because, yeah, YouTube and they... Anyway, so, yeah, another messy video, but leave a comment, let me know what you think.